from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, Richard Rodriguez first came into the public eye with Hunger of Memory, The Education of Richard Rodriguez, a memoir about his early schooling in Sacramento and alienation from his Latino roots. His new book, Darling, deals with questions of faith and character in a series of essays on a range of topics, including 9/11, Christianity, and Cesar Chavez. He'll join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. San Francisco-based writer Richard Rodriguez joins us for this morning's second Forum Hour to discuss his newest book, a meditative series of essays on a wide range of subjects titled Darling. One of our nation's leading essayists, Richard Rodriguez is author of Hunger of Memory, Brown, and Days of Obligation, and he's also a longtime contributor to PBS. He writes for Harper's and the Los Angeles Times, and we welcome him back to the Forum program. Good to see you again. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, this is quite a rich tapestry you've created here in Darling, and there's so many ways to talk about it. But I thought we'd begin talking about it from the perspective of what you say inspired you to write what's titled A Spiritual Autobiography, which maybe comes from the editors, or is that yours?
No, that's me. The exploration for the book began after September 11th. I was quite struck with the fact that those terrorists, as those 757 jets slammed into the World Trade Center and to the Pentagon, they were praying. They were praying to Allah. And as a Christian who adores the same God as the Muslim, as the Jew, it occurred to me that religion is a much more dangerous thing than perhaps I had understood, that this intimacy we claim with God, as ennobling as it can be, can also be terrifying. And it occurred to me for the first time, I think, that the world could end with a prayer.
Well, it also occurs to you that the Abrahamic religions, as you just indicated, are all kind of connected in this way. And part of this, I guess, was inspired by, I know, your bewilderment, but you also came to some kind of conclusion that we're all sort of in this together. We're all siblings, and all the talk notwithstanding about a sky god, we all have a desert god.
Yes.
And you take us out into, at one point in the book, into understanding how Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad were all creatures of the desert, ultimately,
yes,
cast out of cities.
Well, you know, for my life, I've called myself a Roman Catholic. But I think now I really think of my Catholicism, my Christianity, as belonging to the desert. I'm a Christian who comes from the desert.
I thought you were Chinese, didn't you? That's what you used to say.
Well, I'm more Bedouin now.
That could be confusing and sound like too much inside baseball, but you did on a couple of occasions say, I live with so many Chinese people in terms of your neighborhood.
And, yeah, I believe that. I believe still that, you know, certainly San Francisco has become increasingly a Chinese city, Filipino also. And I believe that neighbors change each other and influence each other. And to that extent, I believe that I'm still Chinese. But this religion, this energy that comes out of the desert and that moves into Europe, and we call ourselves, you know, Dutch Reform or German Lutherans or Church of England, those are in some sense misnomers. What is at stake here is a religion that comes out of a desolate plain. And that desolation is the subject of mockery from non-believers. You know, how could... There's nothing out there. By definition, the desert is deserted. For believers, it seems to me the question is, why would God, the Abrahamic God, Yahweh, Allah, why would God choose to reveal himself in that ecology? That's a very interesting question.
It's a fascinating question. And it got you back to, in many ways, your own youth. And Ohala, as your mother used to say to you, in the Arabic etymology and derivation of that, again, seeing a kind of confluence. I wonder, when you talk about those hijackers praying in their last moments to Allah, is there empathy there?
No, there's not empathy. But there is this haunting sense that in the journey, as I got closer to the Arab, that I was getting closer to myself. You're right with ojalá, the Spanish word, the Spanish exclamation that my mother often said. As I moved into the Middle East and started hearing Arabic, I started hearing Spanish. It turns out that there are something like 3,000 to 4,000 Spanish words which are etymologically Arabic in derivation. And so there I was confronting the stranger in the desert and hearing my mother, inshallah, which is the constant refrain of Muslims in the desert, God willing. There is my mother standing in Sacramento, California in the 1950s as I'm about to leave for school, with the binder under my arm, saying, ojalá that the weather will be nice, which is, but let's hope that the weather will be nice today so you don't get wet when you come home from school. Ojalá the sale will be on at pennies so I can buy your shoes this weekend and so forth. That my mother was saying the name of Allah on her lips, ojalá. It was extraordinary to me because I didn't hear it as a child. I heard my mother speaking, and I don't even think my mother heard what she was saying. But in fact, we were remembering the centuries of Muslim Spain, which remains on our lips.
This newest book of yours is not only all about the desert tribe, religions, and some theological searching and questing and all that. It's also about your mother. It's about women in general. It's about the Sisters of Mercy, the nuns, in fact, whom you obviously have a great deal of admiration for. You even mentioned also Jack Furtig and those sisters who you don't necessarily have admiration for, who converted to Islam, as you mentioned.
Yes.
And I remember that. But even the title,
you should say the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence.
Yes, right. I'm sorry, thank you. Even the divorced woman in the title, there's a sense here in wanting to elevate the importance of women and also tie in women and feminists, particularly to your own homosexual identity.
Well, it you know, right after September 11th, the Reverend Jerry Falwell listed a group of Americans who were, in his view, responsible for having brought the wrath of God down upon America. Among them, he listed homosexuals and feminists. That was very interesting to me, that pairing. Recently, Pope Francis said that the church is much too preoccupied with abortion and gay marriage. He was right in saying that, I think. But he didn't explain why the church had been preoccupied by those twin offenses. In writing about in this book, I didn't want to rehearse the familiar lament of the gay man in these religions, these desert religions that have excluded him. I wanted in some deeper way to get to the mystery of sexuality. And women came to loom in my imagination as the center of this book, Darling, the conversation, the long lunch I have with a friend of mine on the day her divorce was finalized in Malibu. That conversation, which is at the center of this book, really engages this question of why women have been marginalized by these patriarchal religions and what that link is between the gay man and his darling. On the day in which we met, she needed so badly to be assured of my tough tenderness, and instead I sounded like an interior decorator going, "Darling, would you want it? You want club sandwiches? Darling, would you like a glass of wine?" And it begins with a quarrel, where she recoils from that darling, and ultimately in the chapter, we come to terms with what it means to be darling in the desert, the two of us. I really think this book is about women and not about my gay identity so much. You know,
But you do say single mothers represent maybe a bigger threat than gay marriage.
Absolutely. And the church doesn't know what to do with that. I mean, the church keeps proposing the family as the model for social organization. But it's clear that that we are now living in reconstructed families where daddy is absent. The majority of American women now living without men. In that way, I thought to myself, I'm as influenced by anyone by the New York media, and for years I was under the impression that the Stonewall riots in the 1970s was a decisive gay event of rebellion, the freedom of our night, the freedom of the nightclub at night, and so forth. As important as that was, it seems to me that in thinking about this, I began to realize that the real, the beginning of my liberation starts with the movement of women in the 19th century out into the streets to demand the vote. Those women,
the suffragette movement.
The suffragettes, yeah. Marching in dark outfits up the Strand. That movement out of the parlor anticipates my movement out of the closet. And in some way, this desire of women to be equal to men in the public space is for me the break from the traditional familial structure. I don't think Oscar Wilde was anything like that influence. I think these women, in demanding equality with men, was the beginning of my own freedom. I mentioned the Sisters of Mercy, those extraordinary women who begin in the 19th century, another group of women. They were women who were allowed by the bishops, the male bishops, to leave the cloister, and they begin to run hospitals and schools and so forth. The Sisters of Mercy are an Irish order, and when they came to San Francisco in the 1850s, a number of anti-Catholic newspapers said, "We don't need you here. We don't want you here." They remained, and in some way they were protected by their sort of burqa-like outfits, these dark-robed women. They were ministering to men in the smallpox epidemic on the wharf. They were setting up tent hospitals in the Presidio. There is a monument to them at the northern entrance of the Capitol, these women who came to California from Ireland. These women were the first feminists of my life. I didn't have a word for them. They were truly free in a world equal to men, and able to run institutions that men had previously run. That was some freedom.
Well, I can't help thinking about the fact you mentioned Pope Francis, because he has said most recently, maybe it's time for a woman cardinal, and there is expectation they may indeed name a woman cardinal. I'm just wondering, you know, I was thinking about a conversation with Cynthia Ozick where she said the difference between writing an essay and writing fiction is that your opinions can change with an essay. And not only that, but, you know, there's the shelf life and all that sort of thing. How about now that Pope Francis is there, in light of some of the things that you were struggling with in this book? It must have seemed like a lot brighter light than a different kind of view.
It's a very old tradition. I mean, he calls himself Francis. St. Francis, after whom the city is named, has a place in my book. The generosity of his touch. There's a story which I tell in the book about the day that Francis of Assisi comes upon a leper on a road, and the leper is making noise, warning others away, and Francis moves away from him and then stops and then comes back and touches him. And that moment, that touch, which Pope Francis in some sense imitates all these centuries later, is a very old tradition. I think the church has forgotten it, but
Isn't it like when he washed the feet of those poor people too? I mean, it's Mary Magdalene, but it's also very much part of the institutionalized church.
Yes, it's
for the poor.
But to give some of these other popes credit too, I speak of John Paul II. I thought his papacy, which was distinguished by the fact that he apologized, he issued 92 apologies for the misbehavior of the church to Jews, to natives and New World natives, to Muslims. This litany of contrition for all the church had done badly. At the end of his life, and again, this is in the book, at the end of his life, he's pulled up in this kind of buggy up the center aisle of St. Peter's Cathedral, St. Peter's Basilica, drooling, his head at an angle. He's dying, and he's dying in front of us. You know, I compare him to Marlene Dietrich, the actress, the German actress, who, when her legs failed her, her fabulous legs failed her, retired to Paris and hid for 10 years in her apartment and would not let the world see her as she declined. This is the pattern. As people get old, we put them in homes, we put them out of sight. There was the Pope on the loggia, dying in plain sight. That was a great moral lesson, it seems to me.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with writer and public figure, public intellectual, Richard Rodriguez, author, journalist, essayist, previously a commentator on PBS's NewsHour, and has a new book out called Darling. You take us also in this book to the desert of Las Vegas and to Elvis and Ike and Tina Turner and, and also I was interested just in talking about Steve Wynn as being the Sultan of Las Vegas and because of his eye problems, comparing him to Tiresias. Only you, Richard, in all due respect, would find those kind of mythic richness or resonance. But Elvis is, you know, everybody calls him the king, and you call him the liberator and the messiah of Memphis.
Yes. Well, the man I saw on stage that night at the Hilton was both male and female. And if I just say about Las Vegas, that it seems to me that the wit of Las Vegas, the charm of it, if you could say it, is that it has taken the lesson of the desert, which is that all will pass. The great Shelley poem.
Ozymandias.
Yeah. That kingdoms will be toppled by the desert and its winds, and everything will turn to sand. This lesson, Las Vegas has taken and turned it into a joke, that Las Vegas decides, we're going to put the Eiffel Tower on that corner across the street from the pyramids, across the street from Lago Como, because nothing is rooted in history and everything passes. The Las Vegas that interests me is this Las Vegas that increasingly is influencing the Middle East. You go to a city like Dubai, for example, which is this vast city in the middle of the desolation. And the woman at the hotel will tell you that we've upgraded you to a suite on the 180th floor or something. And zip, you go up the elevator and you look out of your room and there is a desolation, you know. These buildings that are now being built in the Emirates that defy the horizontal plainness with this verticality of human desire. And of course, in Dubai, you can go to the Ice Palace when you get bored, and you can ski in Dubai. That notion that we are not related to the earth anymore, but the earth is in fact a landscape we can ignore and in some sense we can play with, has now moved even into Mecca, where the architectural engineering firm Bin Laden Associates, founded by the father of Osama bin Laden, a great engineer, he's a peasant basically, but he became a favorite of the royals in Saudi Arabia, has reconstructed Mecca. And there is now, overlooking the Kaaba, the holiest site in Islam, one of the largest hotels in the world, the Fairmont Hotel, that's built in the shape of Big Ben. Well, I thought to myself, you know, that sounds like something that Las Vegas would do. Put Big Ben in the middle of the desert, overlooking the Kaaba. It's the very incongruous detail that seems to me to be an indication that in some way the desert, which incidentally is the fastest growing ecology in the world right now, at a time in which we are sentimentalizing green, the desert drives us mad.
Also is a place where nuclear explosions are tested, Yucca Flats and all those kinds of things. And as you point out, it's the Gulag. It's the desert kind of dovetails in so many ways, on so many both literal and figurative ways that...
As a religious landscape, it occurred to me at the end of the book, there's discussion of the three ecologies of the desert, the three holy ecologies, the mountaintop. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke of the mountaintop at the end of his life. And we recently remembered that with the speech, now 50 years old, in front of the Lincoln Memorial. By the way, liberals who have sort of given religion over to the right wing in America were reminded what it was like to hear 50 years ago Martin Luther King give a sermon, basically, in a civic space. And there was Mahalia Jackson at the foot of the podium calling out to Martin, "Tell him about the dream, Martin, tell him about the dream."
He had given that speech in a different form in Michigan, I guess, a week before that?
Yes. Yeah. It's. I think, you know, Osama bin Laden, who is as secular as anyone in American politics, though he remembers to add God Bless America at the end of his speeches.
Osama bin Laden?
I mean, sorry. Our president. Sorry. I could just see all the Tea Party stirring out of
the slumber. I did it once by mistake. I said Osama instead of Obama.
President Barack Obama gave a speech about the speech 50 years later, and there was nothing in it because we don't talk that way in America anymore. The second ecology I talk about is the ecology of the plain, the plain of Kvetch, where you are stuck for most of your life from youth to old age, to from running to arthritis, this drama of wandering the desert the Jews describe. The third ecology is the ecology of the cave. And this one is interesting because it seems to me that one of the things that desert people know is that it is sometimes very hard to see in the middle of the day when the sun is brightest. Nothing to do with sandstorms and mirage, but to do with the brightness of light. Many times in these desert cultures, there is this sense that wisdom, that contemplation, the conversation takes place at twilight, in the dark. And of course, the Prophet Muhammad has all of his visions in a cave. Jesus is born in a cave and dies in a cave and is resurrected, Christians believe, in a cave. Plato writes the parody of this, and he sees people who live in a cave, the Hindus, the Buddhists, the Christians, the Jews, the Muslims, as people who confuse the figures on the wall with reality. Nonetheless, there is that moment in Exodus where Moses is with God, and God must protect Moses from the sight of his majesty by putting him in a cave. These ecologies teach us that the world that we live in is the world also where mystery occurs to us. It doesn't occur to us outside of our realm. And I think what I'm struck by, there's an essay on the death of the newspaper in San Francisco, The Decline of San Francisco Chronicle, and Herb Cain is in this book, as well as the decline of cemeteries.
The decline of obituaries, yeah. There's a whole section which I found really resonated with me because I know people who die and they get no obits, period.
And they don't want many. In many cases, friends of mine have not wanted obituaries. The change in our patterns of burial, that we are now cremating ourselves, and in many cases we are being either left with the Christmas ornaments in the garage or cast in Muir Woods or somewhere. There is no longer a sense that the dead have a city. Colma is still a city of the dead. And I was recently out there for a funeral of a friend of mine, and she was buried in the Jewish cemetery, which is right down the hill from the Italian cemetery. And then going toward her grave, there was Bill Graham, the tomb of Bill Graham. It was like that you're going down this aisle of grass, looking at these names who had once lived in your city and now live in the city of the dead. Increasingly, we are living in at a time when the dead no longer, or the city of the dead no longer interests us.
Coming up on a break here, we're talking with Richard Rodriguez, and we welcome your involvement in the program. His new book is called Darling, and if you would like to join the conversation, you are cordially invited to do so now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. So your questions, your comments are welcome, and again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website. Our website is kqed.org/forum, and just click on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, but we do welcome your involvement in the program. Again, Richard Rodriguez first came into the public eye with Hunger of Memory, which is subtitled The Education of Richard Rodriguez, a memoir about his early schooling in Sacramento and alienation from his Latino roots. And his new book, Darling, deals with questions of faith and character and a series of essays on a range of topics, including 9/11, Christianity, and Cesar Chavez. And we'll try to talk about perhaps Cesar Chavez more when we return. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with San Francisco-based author Richard Rodriguez, whose new book is called Darling, A Spiritual Autobiography. And you are welcome to join our conversation. It's toll-free at 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Here's somebody on our website who writes, Rodriguez's essays on PBS NewsHour were always so offbeat but weirdly compelling. Even the delivery was odd in a way that pulled you in, wondering if he ever thought of Tennessee Williams' enmeshment in condemnation of Southern culture in the context of Rodriguez's own push and pull with Latino culture and gay culture.
Writers are not completely normal people. I would be a professional tennis player, given my desires. But you know, part of the problem.
Are you good at tennis?
No. But I remember at Harvard at Kennedy School once, this Latina got up and said, you know, I've been waiting for 10 years, she said, to say this in front of an audience. She said, you are screwed up, she said. And I said, well, of course I'm screwed up. Why do you think I'm a writer? That there's this kind of confusion that writers face. And partly the task of writing is to understand. And we hope that the reader is interested in that understanding. I've described essays as biographies of ideas. This is how this idea came to me. And what I try to do, of course, is to give the reader a sense that the ideas that come to us in the day are fleshy. That is, we see somebody passing in front of us and something occurs to us. Ideas happen on a certain day, a cloudy day. Ideas happen when we're seated by ourselves or with other people. And that drama of the way an idea occurs to you is, for me, the way what I'll call the arguments of these essays are engaged in the flesh and blood of living in San Francisco or in Jerusalem. The writer has the task of reminding the reader that the reader is alive. And part of that being alive is the reader is always thinking. Even when he's touching someone or someone is touching him in a moment of embrace, the reader is always thinking.
I want to get to our calls, but I just, you're talking about authors. I remember an evening we had at the Bancroft Library. We were with Maxine Hong Kingston and with Al Young. Talking about California writers, which you talk about here. You talk about California authors as if there's kind of a distinct category. And,
yes.
And I kept finding myself thinking, well, you know, especially you write a good deal about Saroyan and Maxine Howe Kingston.
And Didion.
And Joan Didion, with more from your own territory.
Another Sacramento writer.
Yeah. But I couldn't help thinking that a lot of what you say about California writing applies to American writing in general. That is a sense of loss, a sense of trying to find identity.
And disappointment.
And disappointment, exactly. Whereas when you talk about Chavez, for example, you talk about Mexican identity, his Mexican-American identity. You talk about these two sides almost as being polarized.
Yeah. I think Chavez was had as his ambition to be a saint. The holiest of ambitions.
I told you when I met him, I felt somebody was beatified almost.
Yeah. I remember he was when he was dealing with some of the growers, they were frustrated with him. They would ask, is this a social movement or is it a union movement?
And they also hated him. I mean, really.
Well, they hated him, yeah. but they also found themselves, parochial school children would come home and tell their parents that they were the villains in a morality play at these Catholic schools in the Central Valley, and they were placed within a kind of religious tableau that they didn't completely understand. I think Cesar Chavez as a labor organizer was less than effective. I think his unions shrank. I think that in many ways he was an incompetent. I say that with at the same time acknowledging that part of the anxiety that he felt was with success. He writes when the union starts getting its footing that this is not a union simply to make people middle class. I didn't give so much so that we could become middle class. And already he's thinking about other ways to serve, to help the poor, to help the elderly and so forth. Rather like Martin Luther King Jr., I should say, that success brings with it this quandary. Now what? You know, is this what my life was about? Well, in the American scheme of things, he turns into a 33-cent stamp. He becomes a park. He becomes a name on a building. He becomes a school in his death.
An Apple icon.
An Apple icon. There he is on the billboard. You know, think different. And there is the bitten apple underneath his figure. There is this confusion, it seems to me, of the Mexican and the American. The American becomes a hero. President Obama goes to his grave on a recent pre-election tour to honor the saint. But the saint was sought in his life to be a failure, because that is how he understood to be with people who were losing. And he didn't understand how he could be a winner in America.
That's why you call Jesus the biggest loser on the planet? Because
yeah.
You do.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I think
it's about suffering. Yeah.
It was about suffering. It's about It's about failing in a world in which we are at a loss.
Go to our callers, and we begin, Richard, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. This is quite an honor to me. I admire both of you, but Mr. Rodriguez, I just wanted to tell you, while I've been holding, I have heard you say at least five interesting things. This doesn't happen normally, and your books are like that. And I'm a teacher. I teach English at a community college, and I used your book, Brown, about 5 years.
Which I should say is in the Forum Archives. We talked about it, yeah.
Extraordinary book. And as a piece of...
We bleeped it. Go ahead. Danny's quick. He's quick on the draw as anybody in the Old West, yeah.
All the nonsense of the self. I believe, Mr. Rodriguez, you have become a master of noticing the nonsense of the self. And I think I dabble a bit in writing myself. I think the writer's one of the great purposes, and you fulfill better than anybody I can think of, is to show the reader one's own foolishness, but yet in language that is itself beautiful. That shows the language is the smart one in a way. This is a love letter, as you can tell. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard, very much. Part of the anxiety I feel right now in the age of Steve Jobs is that you end up on interview shows and people want to know your points, your PowerPoints. But these essays I've written are almost to another century, a century of when we used to speak of belles lettres, you know, literature that pleased us by being beautiful or complicated or difficult. I grew up at a time in which the difficult piece of prose was oftentimes admired because it took us into the density of our thought. Now, of course, if it's difficult, that we don't want anything to do with it, and
if it can't be tweeted, it can't be.
I came here to the studio, and the streets around the studio are filled with young people who are looking at their cells for what I don't know. But this neurosis is really interesting, and I don't think that this is an easy time for serious writing.
Thank you for the call, and let me bring another caller on. Jack, you're on. Hi.
Another love letter. We miss you on public television, and I couldn't be more envious of being your friend. It would be so lovely if I had people in my life that were as wonderful as you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jack.
You do elicit strong emotions from your fans.
Well, I also have enemies. I mean, there are places in America I still can't go because of my first book, Hunger Memory, that you didn't say, you're very kind and politic not to say, that in that book that I was very skeptical of affirmative action for middle-class Americans.
I thought we talked that out before.
But they remember it. They remember it at these places. But my skepticism about bilingual education, that's still a problem. And, you know, the Latino movement is largely a language movement. That is, you think of something like Univision, the television network. That exists as an idea because of Spanish. The moment it becomes English-speaking, it will begin to dissolve into the American experience. So that Richard Rodriguez is still a problem. And as a gay man, I must say that I'm not I don't even like the word gay. I mean, I used to.
You know, they tried to get rid of it. Hallmark. Did you hear that? No, it's a news story. Instead of saying Dick the Halls, wait a minute. Don, we now are gay apparel. They said. For a while, Don, we now are fun apparel, and there was all kinds of hell that broke loose, as you could imagine.
You know, one of the things I admire so much about the feminist movement in the 60s is that they invented a word, Ms., which seemed to me...
I think it was Steinem, in fact.
Whoever it was a brilliant stroke. What I'm looking for now as a so-called gay man, I'm looking for a language that is adequate to describe the uniqueness of our lives. I don't want to borrow the heterosexual marriage language. I'm not getting married to my partner. My partner is not a partner. He's not a law partner. I want a language that suggests not so much marriage, but a union of two men that is unprecedented, or shall I say, refers to unions that were not exactly the union of a man and a woman. He is not my bride. I am not his bride. I want a language. And that's the task, I think, that we're using this kind of lazy language to describe something that strikes me as quite fresh.
But what about those who feel that this is the way they express their love, that, you know, we used to joke about marriage as an institution, so is San Quentin, but all that notwithstanding, you know, that they really want to go through with some kind of nuptial and pledge their troth and do all those.
I believe in all of that. I just want to give it a different name. I you know, the old knights who used to cut their arms and bleed into each other, they didn't exchange rings, partly because what they understood is that there was something in their maleness with each other that was not the conventional male-female relationship. I'm just looking for a word. I settle on the world word, which...
How about D.H. Lawrence's word, Blunderbrüderstadt?
Well, I was going to say, I'd settle on the word which the church will not give me, and that is the word love, that I love him. In that sense, I will take the word and I will apply it as I will. And that seems to me revolutionary, that I love him.
Let me talk about this with you for a moment, because there's a writer I know both of us admire, a very Catholic writer named Flannery O'Connor, also a very Southern writer.
But
a lot of her work really takes us into revelation, but it takes us into mystery. And it's almost as if at the heart of a lot of Catholic teaching is mystery. And the mystery is the mystery of love and how love and grace and sanctity and all those things come about in life.
Yeah. I would say also, as a Christian who considers himself a loyal son to the Jews, that the Jews begin this aspect of mystery, it seems to me. And it is everywhere in Flannery O'Connor, where, you know, there is this kind of prissy or this kind of self-assured character who is absolutely astonished by the mystery of life, by the sudden intrusion of mystery in the middle of that self-confidence.
Which is often violent.
Oh, yes, violent, but often very funny.
Well, it's what we used to call black humor until we didn't want to necessarily associate that color with something that was gallows-like or dark.
I think the story that we get in the Bible of Abraham being visited by God, this dry old man being promised a son, is already a kind of a wonderful kind of joke about the desert, that the desert will bloom, and that there is Sarah in the other room, you know, snorting at the whole idea. She and God says to her, you know, why are you laughing? And she says, well, I'm not laughing. And he says, yes, you are. And it begins with that notion that the desert will bloom. And I find that to be really kind of astonishing, that that these desert religions begin with this notion of a birth. They are obsessed with birth, with the birth of a son, with a tribe as numerous as the stars. You know, these are very, very old impulses, and they get us to what I think is some very, very interesting dramas of men and women that we haven't really fully examined. I think at a time in which atheism is becoming more popular in America, albeit English and albeit male, I think women are beginning to ask questions about religion that could reform religion in some new ways by making it as much female as male.
Which prompts me to ask you, and I want to bring more of our listeners into this, but you write about Mother Teresa, and I must confess, in reading your writing about Mother Teresa, I had a hard time ferreting out how you really felt about her, because the king of the atheists, Christopher Hitchens, of course, as we both know, felt, well, he did quite a job on her. I mean, he actually took her over the coals and made her, if anything, anything but a saint. Or,
well, can I say Christopher Hitchens is not exactly my saint either. Christopher Hitchens, who played that game on two sides, on the one hand, he played to the American left by importing from England this new atheism, telling us that God is not great precisely at a time when London was filling with colonials.
By the way, forgive me, you know what Rushdie's remark was when he saw the title of that book? He said, you could have left out the last word.
Yeah. Well, there they were, these English people who were telling us at a time in which London was becoming more Muslim, more Hindu, that God doesn't exist. They came to America at a time that Americans were bewildered by September 11th, and they played to the American left, which is increasingly anti-religious. But I should say also, and don't forget this, Christopher Hitchens also was a proponent of the war in Iraq, and he urged America to insist on lines in the desert that the British had already drawn. And no one in the left seemed to have noticed that Hitchens became a kind of proponent of Winston Churchill's worldview of a world order that was established in the Foreign Office.
I have to come in here for a moment because Hitchens, actually my history with Hitchens goes all the way back to when he wrote a book about the Kurds, and a lot of that had to do with the shaping of his thinking in terms of the Iraq War. I'm not offering that as a defense, but we talked about it on the air during the time that he was alive and so forth, and I became very aware of the fact of just how important that reigned in his own consciousness. But I have to ask you, though, I mean, how do you feel about Mother Teresa? I think it's like Chavez. It's kind of mixed, isn't it?
What I admire about Mother Teresa is that in the last 40 years of her life, the majority of years in her life, when she became this figure of such celebrity in the world, when people reached out to her to touch her also, that she was undergoing enormous doubt and darkness about her religious faith. Now, Hitchens,
she was in the desert, as you said.
Yes, she was in the desert, and that's how she describes herself. Hitchens, of course, is a fundamentalist, and his notion of atheism is one that is unblinking. He's an atheist, whereas her version of doubt and faith is much more textured and complicated. I send her to heaven. I don't know what else I can do at the end of the book. She ascends into heaven from Calcutta, but she dies in the dark. Remember what I said about the cave? She talks about the tunnel, about her life being lived in the tunnel, and at the end of her life, the power is out at the convent. They put on the generator, and the generator goes out, and she literally dies in the dark. It seems to me that that's a magnificent way for a woman who not only doubted, but also lived every day in the service of God and poor. And it seems to me that when I read Christopher Hitchens in Vanity Fair with all these ads for perfume slipping out of the magazine, there was Christopher Hitchens telling me that Mother Teresa was ugly. I thought, oh, we're really in for a kind of English public school humor here that America is not used to. And Hitchens' success in America really does tell us more about the end of empire in both New York and London.
Also Anglophilia. And let me get another caller on. Wanda, that's you. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I wondered if you would comment on the biblical story when Abraham and Sarah finally conceived, and Sarah convinced, I believe, Abraham to expel Hagar, the handmaiden who had a son, out into the desert with basically not enough to live on, more or less to die.
First big Jewish-Muslim split right there.
Yeah, it begins there.
Yeah, it does.
And Hagar becomes the mother of Muslims. I mean, this birth of the son in the desert is the God ministers to her, and the angel is, and there is this promise that from her will come a tribe. True, it's the beginning of the prophetic a possibility that there would be these two lines from Abraham. No, it's quite vivid, and Abraham is for the Muslim as much as for the Jew, father.
Why do you suppose? Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Wanda. Go ahead.
What about the cruelty of sending Sarah, expelling her out into the desert?
You meet no objection on my part. That was Sarah was at that moment, a cruel and I think Abraham at that moment was an unadmirable man when he submits to this pestering wife by essentially willing his son and his slave to death.
Well, he also came very close to killing his own son at God's command. And
yes.
Theologians are often quite puzzled by what kind of God would ask a man to sacrifice his son.
Well, some of the newest thinking about all of that, of course, is that whether or not Sarah would have obliged God. And there is increasingly the sense that a mother would never have gone through that the logic of a God who demands that her son be killed. That there was in that, you know, perhaps too much. I should say, if I can, something about these texts, because we live at a time in which increasingly words don't have any weight in our hands. I mean the Kindle, but I don't only mean the Kindle. I mean that, you know, at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, these two GIs find this Quran, which has annotations in Arabic in the margin. They suspect that the prisoners are exchanging messages to each other, so they throw the Quran into the fire. As secular people in America, we really have to acknowledge or realize that these religions honor the word, honor the weight of the word as part of the meaning of the message of God, so that it is the Quran, the Bible, is kissed, it is danced with in many cases. If you drop the Bible at the Torah in a synagogue, the synagogue is penalized for that act. It seems to me we are living now in a world that is increasingly angrily religious, at a time when we are deaf to what the meaning of religion is. We don't even understand that the word was made flesh, that it exists among us as weight in our hands, to be kissed, to be embraced. We don't understand that. We think that you can push the delete button and it all gets wiped away.
We're talking with Richard Rodriguez. His new book is Darling. Warren says, I was fascinated by your thoughts about the city for the dead. Do you believe in an afterlife? And if so, how does this affect your or our sense of taking care of the world and its people and its environments?
I guess I do believe in an afterlife, and that is, of course, the critique that the ecology movement has about the deaths of religions, that God did not reveal himself in a place like the Swiss Alps that was green and charming, but in a place where nature was desolate, at the bottom of the sea, basically. And there is a sense in which the adversarial nature of the adversarial quality about nature in the desert causes these religious communities to be at war with nature. Nature is always the threat, the danger. Dreaming of green, dreaming of Eden, dreaming of the restoration of Eden in a kind of prelapsarian way.
Do you remember the Woody Allen line, I am two with nature?
Well, I mean, I go to Whole Foods and my cereal has a prelapsarian message on it. This, the new ecology movement, which is seeking a green. It's a secular green.
I think prelapsarian means before the fall,
yes.
Eden.
Well, on my cereal box, the proprietor of the cereal company that Whole Foods sells says, always leave the world better off than when you found it, which is a prelapsarian dream, but it's in secular terms. Oprah Winfrey and Bono, I remember one day afternoon, were urging on us a green world in which, at the same time, they were flying off on private airplanes, you know. Nature is brown.
Confronted Robert Kennedy Jr. with that fact, because he's a leading ecologist. And I said, you're flying around on a private plane. I mean, it just seemed to me very logical. To which he gave the usual explanations of, you know, but I have to move.
The prophet has to be the exception.
Yeah, well, in effect. Let me bring another caller on. And Neil, that's you. Good morning.
Yeah, what's your opinion of George Orwell as an essayist? Have you read much of him? Do you think much of him?
Orwell is a master. Orwell is...
do share something with Christopher Hitchens. He loved Orwell.
Yes, well, I will forgive Hitchens at this moment. Orwell understood. He never, in the course of his writing about the moment, about historical events, about what is happening around us, never stopped writing elegantly about the world. It seems to me that that's sort of what I miss in the conversation we're having about Barack Obama or Tea Party or nature becoming more green. I think that if I hear the word iconic one more time, I think I'll have a nervous breakdown. We're not using language in any complicated way.
How about awesome?
Yeah, awesome is good.
You think awesome about awe and what that should mean denotatively, and it's just used, boy, that burger was awesome. I mean, you know, you hear it especially.
It's called non-thought.
talking again with Richard Rodriguez, his new book, Darling. You talk, let me go to Sacramento with you, because you write about these two temples of your youth. You write about the Alhambra Theater on the one hand and the
Sacred Heart Church.
Catholic Church, yeah.
It's a beautiful church, still exists. But the Alhambra Theater was my first exploration into Andalusia. You know, there it was. The success of Rudolph Valentino in the movies convinced a lot of theater owners to construct the theater as a kind of Arabic temple, you know. And that's where we used to go to the movies before they were torn down for the multiplex.
There are too many young listeners who don't know that the Sheik was who Rudolph Valentino was so much identified with.
Yeah.
Out of the desert again.
He was the desert lover, yes. Yeah. And already there is this suggestion in the Andalusian fantasy, the meeting of Europe with the desert, the Arabian desert, some romance, which we're still playing with today. In that chapter, I also talk about how, you know, in going to Bible movies, the Arab was a kind of backdrop to these English actors wandering around playing Romans. And
You've read Said. I mean, they're made into this Orientalist fantasy, and often, you know, with daggers, and they're dangerous and perilous in every single way.
And comic.
Yeah. Always great to have you. Thank you for being with
thank
us.
Thank you, Michael.
And thank you for your work. Again, the new book is called Darling, Richard Rodriguez. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And we remind you to continue this conversation on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and continuing the conversation in any way you see fit. Want to also let you know who is behind the scenes here. Our our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauberg. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Our engineer, Danny Bringer. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.